problem we're focusing on today is the Middle East, and it'll be our benefit today to hear the history that led to that situation which we see now. So let me speak of our speaker. Michael Reynolds is an associate professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton. He teaches courses on Ottoman history, the modern Middle East, and the Caucasus, and Russia, and Muslim Eurasia. This is a marvelous background that he has covered in a number of ways, I've just learned sitting beside him at lunch. He's the author of Shattering Empires, The Clash and Collapse of the Ottoman and Russian Empires, a fascinating study, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2011. And that book was the co-winner of the American Historical Association's George Louis Beer Prize, a Financial Times Book of the Summer also that year. And he just recently, this year, he has contributed a chapter to call Regional Realities and Washington's Vision, The Path to Wars, in a book that was called Understanding the U.S. Wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, with which we're concerned today. He's currently working, and this I think is fascinating, on a biography of the Ottoman Minister of War and Young Turk Triumvir. I looked that up to be careful. It is that he was a member of the three-person group that ruled the country at that time. Enver Pasha. And that book will examine the dynamic relationship between geopolitics and the intellectual and cultural sources of resistance to the Western-dominated global order, something significant today. He's done consulting for government and private institutions on Middle Eastern affairs and written for major U.S. newspapers and magazines. Professor Reynolds holds a B.A. in Government and Slavic Languages and Literature from Harvard, an M.A. in Political Science from Columbia, and most important, a Ph.D. in Near Eastern Studies from Princeton. Now, today he is going to, for us, link history to the current panorama of warfare in the Middle East. It's a great pleasure then to introduce Michael Reynolds.
Thank you very much for the introduction. As Rick said, this is certainly very interesting times in the Middle East, and I think I'm grateful, though, that I can observe those interesting times from my perch in Princeton rather than being in the Middle East, although I often travel there in the summer, particularly to Turkey, to Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan, for those of you who might not know, Azerbaijan's over here. I actually had, not this past summer, the summer before, 2014, a group from Princeton. We spent 6 weeks there. 15 students from Princeton teaching what they call a global seminar. This summer, again, I was back in Turkey. I was also in Iraq, in Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. And things are bad in the Middle East, and they're getting worse. I wish I could say the interesting times are only for historians. They're very much for people who are writing and reading newspapers, and they will continue to be. I see no prospects that things are going to get better there, and unfortunately, as Rick said, those interesting times are coming to us. I mean, they have been for some time, but I think we're only going to face more turbulence from the Middle East. Certainly Europe is facing that problem, and the United States is going to be grappling with it again for some time to come. So today, I'm glad I was, as many of you probably have noticed in taking courses in history at Princeton, if you ever ask an historian to explain something, they'll always say, well, to understand that, you have to go to the period before. And I'm definitely going to do that today, and I am going to talk about some history, because I think, well, the history is important, and in particular, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the deep history, but I am going to spend a little bit of time talking about the origins of the Ottoman Empire, which sounds, how could this possibly relate to what's going on today? So that you might understand what is the Turkish perspective on events in the Middle East today. And so my talk is going to have three parts. The first part will be, I'll explain a little bit about the emergence of the Turkish Republic and why they are so essentially effectively paranoid about the Kurds. And Turkey is important in this because Turkey is the closest U.S. ally in the region. We can discuss in questions and answers, is it really an ally? That's an excellent question in itself, worthy of its own lecture. So Turkey's actually critical for U.S. Policy there, and it's something that the U.S. policymakers, I don't think, really understand the depth of the problem inside of Turkey, why Turkey and the U.S. are at loggerheads over what to do about Syria. So I'll talk a little about the emergence of the Turkish Republic and what has informed their perspective, how do they interpret the events taking place around them. Then I'll say a few words about the Kurds, who many see as now our best potential allies in the Middle East. Who are they? And what are their objectives, and why is it that they are at loggerheads or actually at war with, I shouldn't say they, that's something else, some Kurds at war with the Turkish state, and what they're trying to do in Syria. And then the final part of my talk will speak a little bit about Russia's role in the civil war in Syria. And then I'll open it up to questions. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions about what I've spoken about or the things that I have not spoken about but they're related to the topics, because this really is quite complex, and one could, as you might imagine, we could spend a month lecturing on these things. So just to start off, this is simply a map of the Middle East as we know it today. This is what the Middle East we think should look like and its borders. But as I mentioned, I want to talk a little bit about Ottoman history. Let me see as far as the I can get this to advance. If I click. Here's the, okay. Right, so this is a map showing the expansion of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was founded in 1299 by some by the name of Osman. That's where we get the name Ottoman. It's simply his first name. In 1299, and I'm not going to narrate right now how the empire expanded and how it was founded. I just want to bring your attention to one very important fact, if you want to understand Turkey today. If you are like me, I think most Americans, I think, were like me when I first started studying Ottoman history. I didn't know anything about it, of course, when they started. I assumed, well, you know, Turkey, Ottoman Empire, they're related. The Ottoman Empire, I knew, had ruled over the Middle East, and twice the Ottomans had tried to take Vienna. And I had assumed, well, the Ottoman Empire probably began, you know, someplace in the middle of Anatolia, Ankara, Konya. Then they probably unified Anatolia, went out to the rest of the Middle East, conquered that, and once they had the Middle East behind their back, then they started to push into Europe and steadily tried to get to Vienna, and twice, and they failed. So the basic idea that I assumed it sort of started here, and here was the heartland of the Ottoman Empire. Now, if you look at this map, it shows when the Ottoman Empire began, 1299 or 1300, it begins here. And you'll notice that the early parts of expansion are in western Anatolia and then very early on in the Balkans. So this is the historical heartland of the Ottoman Empire, not these parts of Anatolia, and certainly not the rest of the what we think of the Middle East, the Arab world. And you see it was very early on, it's really quite deep into Europe. Now, as the Ottoman Empire began to experience a period of decline and was basically broken up, largely as a result of the great powers, the European powers, the British, Austria-Hungary, of course, played a role in this, France, and probably first, most importantly, Russia. And this is a process that began at the end of the 18th century. So the Ottoman Empire in 1774 was the first time when they signed a treaty and had to surrender territories. That was to the Russian Empire. They had to give up the Crimea. So they lost these territories to Russia. And that was a sign that the empire was on the downslide. It was never able, again, to become what we might say called today a peer competitor. So this is a process that begins at the end of the 18th century, and then throughout the 19th century, it really accelerates. And this is a map showing the breakup of the Ottoman Empire from the period 1878 to 1913. So this is roughly speaking the last three decades of the Ottoman Empire. And again, I'm not going to narrate everything here, but I just want to draw your attention to this process of breakup. So they lose a number of territories, 1877-78, they lose the war with Russia, this is where they lose the bulk of their territories in the Balkans, as well as more territory in the Caucasus. So Russia's been pushing down this way, and has taken Crimea, and has also taken the Caucasus. So So they're feeling that pressure from the north, and they're feeling pressure coming from the west, as they see the French grabbing territories in North Africa, the British taking Cyprus and Egypt. So there is, within the Ottoman Empire, there's a feeling we're losing our empire, which of course anyone who's running an empire must see that as a tragedy. But it's more than that. One might say, well, the French lost their empire, the British lost their empire. What makes it the breakup and destruction of the Ottoman Empire an even more traumatic event for the Ottomans is the fact that when they lose, one is that these territories that they're losing here in the end of the 19th century, 1878, these are very old parts of the empire. This is the heartland of the empire, which they virtually lose all of it in the Balkan Wars in 1912, 1913. And these are wars that are accompanied not just by military conflict, but by mass ethnic cleansing. And when they lose these territories, if you're sitting here in Istanbul, and you see gradually, again, this is a process that starts in the end of the 18th century, and then begins to accelerate in the 19th century, and as you're going to the 20th century, it looks like it's only taking on more and more speed. And what accompanies the loss of the Ottoman territories in the Balkans is not just their nominal political control, but this mass ethnic cleansing. So you have some 400,000 Muslims are expelled from the Balkans. And I think the way probably to describe what that would be like with how that felt to the Ottomans in 1913, in American terms, would be something like if you were sitting in New Jersey or New York, and you had suddenly refugees flowing in, not from, let's say, California or Texas. Imagine that Mexico was a powerful state and it was driving Americans out of there, but instead from Ohio. You know, I mean, where he is today, okay, California is part of the United States, but how more upsetting that is to lose an area like Ohio. Not only is it close to you, but you think this was not quite an original 13 colony, original one of the 13 colonies, pretty darn close. And if you imagine you've got people showing up, driven out of their homes, with stories of how their families got killed, all their possessions taken, you would imagine this would look like, this would be quite a traumatic experience. So it's not as if, I think this is a common misperception I think that people have, when they imagine the Ottoman Empire breaking up, it was probably something like the British. You know, the British lose India, they aren't happy about it, or let's say the French lose Vietnam, Indochina. They may not be happy about it, but they knew at the back of their minds, well, we had no business being there anyhow. It wasn't really ours to start with. So it's not that big a loss. For the Ottomans, it's a huge deal because, yes, this is our homeland where we were living for 400 years, and this is a period longer than the United States has been in existence for. And the next question that arises is, if we've lost all those territories, what's going to be the future of what we have here, Anatolia? Because they get a sense the Arab territories are going to go as well. So the fear going into World War I is that we're fighting a war that's going to be for our backs are up against the wall, quite literally, and we're going to have to fight a war for the possession of this territory. We have nowhere else to go, and if we lose the war, that's the end of us, and it's the end of our children. So they really saw the war in quite apocalyptic terms. And sure enough, when studies World War I, as I have, one looks at what were the Allies planning to do with the Ottoman Empire after the war? That is, what were the British and the French and the Russians thinking of doing? Now, many of you have probably heard of the Sykes-Picot peace treaty. This is the peace treaty that many people blame today for causing all these problems in the Middle East. And it's one that foresaw the establishment of an independent Iraq. As you'll come back here, I should just point this out. You'll notice this is all Ottoman Empire. You don't have an independent Iraq, you don't have a Syria, etc. Those ideas really begin to take some kind of shape in the Sykes-Picot agreement, where the British and the French are thinking, how are we going to divide up the Arab lands? But it wasn't just Sykes-Picot, it was also somebody by the name of Sazonov, who was the Russian foreign minister, was also a key player in this peace treaty. And the peace treaty was not simply for how are we going to divide the Arab world, but it was also how are we going to divide Anatolia. And you'll notice here, basically what they see they're going to leave up to the Ottomans, they're going to leave some kind of sultanate, a very small principality, where you would, the Turkish, the Ottoman Sultan, would be left to rule over this territory, but this Istanbul would essentially be under Russian control and rule, and then you have the Italians were going to get a good chunk of Anatolia on the Mediterranean and the Aegean coast. The French would be also in southeastern Anatolia, and then the Russians would have a good chunk of the territories, northeastern, or the whole swath, I should say, maybe of eastern Anatolia, linking to the Russian-controlled Caucasus. So that's what World War One, the end of World War One, would have looked like had the Russian Revolution not taken place. Of course, the Russian Revolution did take place. Russia fell out of the war. And one might think, well, maybe that's why we never hear of Sykes-Picot-Sazonov, and that was the end of it. Well, that wasn't the end of it. This was the idea in 1920 of how the great powers, the European powers, thought, what are we going to do with this territory, former Ottoman territory of Anatolia? And it's basically the same idea as the Sykes-Picot-Sazonov agreement. And this is a treaty called the Treaty of Sèvres, signed in 1920, with the exception, with the substitution, I should say, that instead of this territory going to Russia, it was going to go to a large, greater Armenia. So there'd be an Armenian state, which would have a good chunk of what we today think of as Turkey. And they also envisioned that there would be a Kurdish state in this part of southeastern Anatolia. And the idea was that that state would get independence probably after about 5 years. So initially, it would be affiliated with this rather small Turkish principality, but then the expectation was about 5 years or so, the Kurds would be brought up to speed and they would get their own state. So this is what things look like again after World War One. Now, of course, that's not the map that I initially showed you at the beginning of the lecture. We saw today's map where you have Turkey. So what happened? Basically, what happened is you had the emergence of someone by the name of Mustafa Kemal, who this is a picture of him roughly at the time of what the Turks call their War of Independence. And what he did was he rallied the Muslims of Anatolia. That is, many of them were Turks, but not all of them. Many of them were Kurds, and a mixture of other groups, people who had been expelled from the Balkans. So you had Albanians, you had Bosnians, you had Muslim Bulgarians, and you had a number of other smaller peoples who lived in Anatolia, Muslims, Laz, and I could go on and name them, basically gathered them together and said, look, we all are facing a major problem here. We're going to lose the last bit of territory that we claim is our own, is our homeland. So unless we draw together and fight against this plan to partition us, again, it's going to be the end of us and of our children. So he's able to rally, effectively, the Muslims in Anatolia, and they are able to defeat the proxies of the great powers, especially the Greeks and the Armenians. The French decide, ultimately, we're not going to fight them. The Italians even pulled out a bit earlier. And ultimately, the British decide at the end of World War One, we've got enough problems going on with our own empire and worrying about things in the rest of the world. We're not going to take on this guy, Mustafa Kemal. Now, he's the one who essentially establishes the Turkish Republic, which has the borders that we know today. There are two small things I should mention, is that originally, the Mustafa Kemal and his comrades also laid claim to this territory around Mosul. This is a province that they said should really be part of this new entity that we're going to establish, which they didn't give the name Turkey. However, the British, who were in control of Iraq, did not want to see this province go to Turkey because the British recognized that inside of Iraq there were oil fields. And World War One, one lesson that the British had taken from World War One was that in industrial warfare, particularly for navies, but also more generally for armies as well, oil is extremely valuable. So what's going on in Iraq, these oil fields, are something that we want to maintain control of. And they thought having this province up here in Mosul would make their control of Iraq that much more secure. And so the British insisted on the Sul to be part of Iraq. And this was a major point of contention between Mustafa Kemal and the early Turkish Republic in Britain. But ultimately, the British simply refused to give that territory to the Turks. And as a result, the borders were ultimately designed, drawn this way. Now, as you may know, when you think of Mosul, and if you know anything about Iraq, this is a heavily Kurdish region. And it might sound confusing to you what I'm saying. Well, why is it that Turkey, when you think, okay, Turkey's the country of Turks, why do they want Mosul? Well, the fact is that, as I mentioned earlier, this wasn't a struggle of Mustafa Kemal. It wasn't so much a struggle of Turks against the great powers and the Greeks and the Armenians for control of Anatolia. It was really a struggle of the Muslims of Anatolia. And the Kurds were a very important part of this. In particular, the Kurds were afraid of, if you go back to this map here, and I'll say a few words more about the Kurds and where they live and who they are in a moment. But this idea of Greater Armenia was one that frightened the Kurds immensely. Because these territories, this part of Anatolia, was at that time, and still much of it remains today, very heavily Kurdish. So the claims of the Armenians, basically the borders of Armenia and the borders of Kurdistan, that is the land of the Kurds, overlap tremendously. So this is one big incentive for why Kurdish tribes joined with Mustafa Kemal and helped him in establishing what became the Turkish Republic. Now, had Mosul gone, being a heavily Kurdish area, with not too many Turkic peoples living there, had that been part of the Turkish Republic, history might have been very different for moments that I will, for reasons I'll describe in a moment. The one other thing I should just mention this map is that this border, this part of Syria right here, known as either Hatay or Alexandretta, was given to Turkey only in 1938 or 39. The French ultimately decided to let the Turks, have been claiming it, ultimately the French cut a deal and said, okay, you can take it in 1938-39. And that's been something the Syrian government has now always been kind of dissatisfied with. So these borders certainly aren't as old or as stable as many people assume. Now, Mustafa Kemal takes the name Atatürk. He adopts that name in 1934 when it requires all citizens of Turkey have to take a name. And he takes the name Atatürk, which means simply father of the Turks. Now, this is part of his policy of basically, essentially, Turkification. Once they have this territory, as you can see this map, I'll explain the slogan in a moment. This is a map of Turkey. Once they establish this thing called the Turkish Republic, they decide, when I say they, I should mention Mustafa Kemal was got his start as an Ottoman officer, fought for the Ottoman Empire before World War I, then during World War I. And he and his backers, the founders of the Turkish Republic, were overwhelmingly Ottoman officers. And this is significant because these are guys who bled to save the empire. And they're committed professionally to preserving the political independence of whatever entity it was that they were fighting for. So whether they called themselves Ottomans, whether they called themselves Turks, it wasn't important. So they are the guys on the playing field that represent the team. And they want to win. Number two, they were very well educated, certainly by Ottoman standards, in European languages and read widely in European languages. Many of them had traveled in Europe and were very much attuned to what Europeans were thinking and, of course, the way Europeans were running the world. And they understood that if we're going to preserve our sovereignty over this territory of Turkey, we have to put an end to the problem of breakup and dismemberment of the empire, which had been conducted by the European powers in the name of ethnic self-determination. This is a relative, today it sounds, when we oftentimes we think of a country, I remember when we invaded Afghanistan, many Americans were really surprised to find out that, well, in Afghanistan, they don't speak Afghani, that there is no such language called Afghani, there's no such ethnic group, because we assume most states throughout the world are naturally represent a certain nation, a certain group of people. So they're in Japan, when they speak in Japan, Japanese, and they're Japanese people. If they're France, they're French. Of course, in a place like Afghanistan, you discover, well, there is no Afghanistan. There's a bunch of people. There are Pashtuns, there are Tajiks, Uzbeks, and one could go on and on. Turkey wasn't all that much different. And they knew that if we don't, or they decided that if we don't insist upon homogenizing our population, we're going to lose control over Anatolia because the great powers will begin agitating among one small ethnic group, be it the Kurds, be it some Arabs who live in Turkey, be it Laos, et cetera, et cetera. We will be broken up. So essentially, it's like united we stand, divided we fall. And in order for us to be united, we have to have one identity, and that's going to be Turkish. And so this slogan here kind of encapsulates this policy that Turkey adopted in the 1920s and has followed up until probably about the last decade of insisting that the only acceptable identity inside of Turkey is a Turkish ethnic identity. And that is, so the Turkish name of the Turkum DNA, which translates what joy it is to he who says or she that says, I am a Turk. It doesn't sound very elegant. It's more elegant than Turkish. It's not quite as elegant in English. But what's written here, it's not saying what joy to him or to he or to him or to her who is a Turk, but rather to who says, I am a Turk. That is, you can be a Turk simply by saying you are a Turk. So the understanding of the Turkish Republic was not that in order to be a Turk, you have to have a mother and a father who are Turkish. The idea was basically, is you are Muslim, and you say you identify as a Turk, that's good enough. And then you should speak Turkish, of course. But that any Muslim can become a Turk. And again, if we don't all insist upon this, outside powers are going to begin agitating among us, break us up, and we're going to lose our unity, and we're going to lose our territory. So it's not insignificant when you see this. You see Mustafa Kemal, there's a tremendous cult of personality in Turkey, established around the father of the Republic. Then you see him, the symbol of the Turkish Republic, the star and the crescent, and the map, along with the slogan, what joy to he who says, I am a Turk. And this is one, because one of the major sources of anxiety, if not the major source of anxiety in the Turkish Republic today is, well, these borders aren't unchangeable. They insist that they are unchangeable, but they know well from the history that they aren't. Now, to sort of emphasize this Turkish nationalism, you know, so you saw that slogan on a picture with the rendering of Mustafa Kemal. You will find various slogans throughout put on the Turkish countryside. Particularly in the Kurdish southeast, you'll see many of these, where you have many non-Turks living. And again, this is the same thing, name with the Turkum DNA. That's one example. And it's sort of eerie when you see this as you're driving through the country. So this is just another sign where you see it in the countryside. So if you're riding a bus, or you could be in a car, and you'll again, going through the countryside, you'll suddenly see this on a hillside. This is another slogan. It says, basically, the martyrs for the Turkey, Şehitler Ölmez, which means never die. That is, you know, people who die in defense of this country have eternal life. It's almost sort of a religious statement. And then this says, Vatan Ölmez, that is, the homeland is indivisible. Now, the reason why that slogan, again, they're putting this on, literally putting it on the homeland, it's sending a signal that this country, we will not permit this country to be partitioned. We will not permit it to be partitioned the way that the Ottoman Empire was partitioned. And that's sending a message in particular to a group of people in Turkey, the Kurds. Now this program of Mustafa Kemal and of the Turkish Republic of Turkifying the population has been astoundingly successful. When you travel to Turkey, if you were there in the 1920s, the ethnic diversity was really quite stunning. I could go through and name. I named some of the groups before. Yeah, again, you have Turks, Albanians, Circassians, Bosnians. I could go on and on and on. Today, when you speak to Turks, overwhelmingly have people say, oh, I'm a Turk. Now, maybe some of them might be, oh, well, you know, my roots come from the Caucasus, and so we're Circassian. Originally, we were Pomaks, and we came, we were Muslims from Bulgaria, but it's a very vague kind of understanding. Not, it's almost sort of, I think, like, I don't know, maybe third-generation Americans might remember, oh, we used to be Polish-American or German-American. It doesn't really mean anything politically. And it's, so it's been an amazing success, this it's an own form of a melting pot strategy, with one major exception, and that exception is the Kurds. And that's what I want to speak about right now, just give you an overview of who in the world are the Kurds. So maybe I should just say who the Kurds are in terms of their language. Kurdish, one I should point out, there is no single language as Kurdish. Most people assume there is a Kurdish language. There is none. There are three major dialects, some would maybe add a fourth, but there are three major dialects. They are not mutually comprehensible. So if you speak one, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to understand the others, but they are certainly related. They are dialects. They are all Indo-European languages, so that means they're not all that, they're related in some sense to English. They're more closely related to Persian. And so you'll find words in Kurdish, as you'll find in Iranians, versus birader, pader, you know, it's like the English brother and father. So, and this is significant because the Kurdish, like Persian, it's not a Semitic language, so it's completely different from Arabic, and it's completely different from Turkish. Now, we usually think of the Middle East, and when we teach it at Princeton and many other places, usually taught, so they call them the big three. The big groups in the Middle East are the Arabs, the Turks, and the Persians. That is Iran, the various Arab countries, and Turkey. They're the largest groups in terms of population. The Arabs are relatively new. The oldest group there has been the Persians, and along them the Kurds. They've been there essentially from time immemorial. The Arabs, it's only after the establishment of the Arab caliphates, the expansion of their conquests in the 7th century, that you begin to see the Arabs come out of Arabia and then begin to, a process that takes many centuries, form what is today the Arab world. The Turks show up in the Middle East in significant numbers only in the 11th century. And they come from where? They emerge, the earliest signs we know for sure the Turks go back to the 8th century, in Siberia, near Lake Baikal. We have the earliest inscriptions, so they begin coming out of Central Asia and slowly then moving to the Middle East, and it's only again in the 11th century where they begin showing up in the Middle East in significant numbers. So I'm emphasizing this in terms of the Kurds are a group that's entirely distinct linguistically from the Arabs and from the Turks, although they do share the religion of Islam. Here's where they're distributed in the Middle East. This is an old map of the Soviet Union, but the information is still quite accurate, and it's a good map because it gives you a broader view. And you'll see that they're concentrated in the southeast and eastern parts of Turkey, and northern Iraq, the western parts of Iran, and in the northeastern part of Syria here. Now, I should mention that what's significant, it is significant about this territory here, there are two things. One is you'll notice it's very much inland, very far from any large body of water, meaning it's a rather isolated place. And what this leads us over to the process over, or the fact that for centuries, this area in the Middle East has always been largely backwater. It's not nearly, you have Baghdad, an ancient city of civilization, of course, is on rivers. You have Istanbul, of course, has been a major source of, a place of trade, and likewise, the coast was in Beirut, etc. So it's always been relatively isolated, number one, which has meant that no one has really cared that much about the territory. And also, you have no major cities. Usually cities always spring up where you have access to water, either right on a port that's near the oceans or on the river that will get you to the oceans. You don't have that in the Kurdish areas. In addition to that, you have mountains. Now, mountains are great if you want to get away from centralized state control. So when people want to conscript you or tax you, you can run away from them and you can go up into the mountains. But it's not such a great place if you wanted to form a state, that is, you wanted to bring people together under centralized government. So it's a good place for rebels, but it's not a great place for establishing states. And the Kurds, in part because, you know, the other thing, the effect of living in mountains, of course, is that it keeps people separated. It's very difficult to cross mountains, to talk to other people, to conduct trade with them. And that is one reason why the Kurds have there is no single Kurdish language. You've never had a Kurdish state to bring people together. You've never had the idea until the 20th century, of the idea of having a state that would unify the Kurds, or a sense among the Kurds that they are a single people. Instead, the Kurds identify themselves primarily with the tribe that they live with, or the religion as being Muslims. And so this area, just as it is today, it's divided up into several different states, has been divided between what's empires in the past, and today it's been divided by nation states, because no one has, and it's a relatively isolated area, not very well economically developed, and so again, along with that, you don't have good infrastructure for either roads or schools, and you have a population that correspondingly is also rather undeveloped. Now this is a map a little more showing the Kurds that's a little more up to date, to the extent that it shows in northern Iraq. Now many of you know that there's this Iraqi Kurdistan, there's some kind of government there. It's usually called the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government. And this is what's shown right here. Now you might assume, okay, Kurdistan Regional Government, it sounds like there's somehow the Kurds in Iraq are unified. But if you know a little more about the Kurds, you might know in Iraq, you might know that there is a group called the Kurdish Democratic Party, the KDP, who happens to be here, and then another one called the Kurdish the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the PUK. So the KDP and the PUK, and you might, well, Kurdistan Democratic Party, Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, sounds like these are competing ideologies. Maybe it's something like, you know, one group is the Democrats, the other is the Republicans, and that the basic division here is ideology. Well, actually, they aren't really so much separated by ideologies. What they are separated by is, again, linguistic and tribal differences. The PUK speaks a variant of or language that is known as Sorani, whereas the ones in the north, the KDP, speak a language that's known as Kurmanji. So these are two of the major dialects of Kurdish. And likewise, when you look a little scratch, so there's this big ethno-linguistic division, and there are tribal divisions as well in this among the Kurds inside of Iraq. And there is, and the government itself is to this day quite divided. In fact, you hear about the Peshmerga, their armed forces. Well, both the KDP and the PUK still continue to maintain their own units. That is, there is no unified Kurdish military inside of northern Iraq. Now, I'm going to talk about, this is another map, which you've essentially seen that. Now, what happens inside of Turkey? So I said a little bit about Kurds inside of Iraq. Now, inside of Turkey, no one knows exactly how many Kurds live in Turkey, because the Turkish Republic is part of its ideology that we are all Turks. It is forbidden to conduct research on people's ethnic identity. So there are no hard figures exactly how many Kurds there are. Estimates are that there's something 12%, some people go as many as 20% of the Turkish population, of Turkey's population, is Kurdish. So that would mean Turkey's roughly 80 million people. It's probably something estimates are literally run from 10 to 20 million. My estimate is right, 12 to 15 million Kurds live there. Just one while we're on this map, perhaps shows it better. So you have a significant, when you have over 10% of the population, that's already a pretty good number. And that's one reason why the Turks have not been able to assimilate the Kurds, because for a long time the Turks knew, of course, we had Kurds living among us. But the idea was eventually they're going to become Turks. But they did, they have not become Turks, unlike the other groups that I mentioned, the Circassians, etc. So one reason is because there are a significant number of them. again, when you have a population of about 10%, that's large. And when you're talking in terms of 80 million people, again, that's something you have some 12, maybe even as many as 20 million, but more like 12 to 15 million. The other factor is that they are compactly settled, primarily, and this is a bit of an exaggeration, these areas up here, many Kurds are here, many Turks as well, but down here in the southeast of Turkey, this is a part of Turkey that is predominantly Kurdish. So if you were born and grow up here, you might go to school and be told, now you're going to speak Turkish. You might watch the television and be told, we're all Turks. But you'll notice, well, in my home we're speaking Kurdish. I speak Kurdish with my neighbors. My whole village speaks Kurdish. In fact, the city I live in, most of us speak Kurdish. You're not going to convince people over a couple of generations, hey, we used to be Kurds, but now we're Turks. It becomes very difficult to assimilate them. That is, there's a large number of them, and they are compactly settled. So inevitably, they began to chafe the Kurds in Turkey under this policy of always being told, you're Turks, you're Turks, you're Turks. They said, wait a second, actually, we're Kurds. And in 1978, an organization that's known as the Kurdistan, this is a workers' party, it shouldn't have it either, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known usually by its initials PKK, so you'll see that a lot in the newspapers, was founded by someone by the name of Abdullah Öcalan, who was a Kurd from Turkey, who was a student in a university in Turkey, and basically started studying Kurdish nationalism, Turkish nationalism, and thought, well, wait a second, the Turks have their own father Turk, well, we Kurds deserve our own figure. And basically, in essence, you can see him to some extent as a Kurdish Ataturk, that he's borrowing this model that he learned from the Turks, saying they have a father of their nation, I'm going to be the father of the Kurdish nation. So he established this thing called the Kurdistan Workers' Party in 1978. In 1984, it begins a war against the Turkish state. They start a guerrilla warfare, they start carrying out terrorist attacks. And as you might be suggested by the name Workers' Party, something founded in the Cold War, you look at this red star, it has, seems like it might have something to do with the Soviet Union. And sure enough, the PKK drew a lot of its ideology from Marxism-Leninism. And one of the influences upon Öcalan, not just the mustache, I think, comes more from the Middle East, but it might remind you of Joseph Stalin's mustache. Borrowed in many ways, his interpretation of Marxism-Leninism is not all that different from Stalin's, and there's a similar emphasis in this party on not only the ideology of revolution, but also on the cult of personality built around the individual of Abdullah Öcalan. And this is a recent sort of montage put out by the PKK, and you can see the central figure of Abdullah Öcalan. He's currently in jail in Turkey, but still is a revered figure by PKK. And you see him as the father of their organization and of the Kurdish nation. You'll see Kurdish militants. It's interesting here. I won't say anything about this now, but it could in questions and answers. Women here. This is kind of a representation of this very revolutionary ideology of the Kurds. Öcalan is someone who was in a Turkish university, was aware of the fact that we Kurds have suffered from the fact that we are a very tribal people. We are still very close to Islam. And if we're going to become what we might call modern people, we need to change radically. And this is one of the reasons that led him to adopt this Marxism-Leninism, because he wanted to smash essentially Kurdish culture and Kurdish traditions in order to create a new Kurdish people. So they began a war and struggle against the Turkish Republic in 1984. That war had its ups and downs, which I'll spare you the details of them, but it's a war that continues today, and that was really reignited in a very big way at the beginning, well, I'd say in the summer of this, it was August of this year, at the same time that Turkey said it was going to support the United States in fighting the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. This is an image of Kurdish children, and I put this here because this is one of Turkey's problems that made fact, this came from a presentation I gave about 8 years ago. And I was pointing out how the Kurdish problem is going to remain a big problem for Turkey, simply because the numbers of Kurdish families are quite large, and you have a large generation of Turkish children, and many of these are the ones now fighting inside of Turkey. That is, they're about age 16, 17 now. And it's, again, the figure of Abdullah Öcalan. These are some Kurdish militants inside of Turkey. They've got some bonfires going with tires, and they're waving the image of Öcalan. This is, again, so you can see how polarized Turkey is. This is from the elections last year. And this color right here, sort of beige color, is for the ruling party, the AKP, it's usually called the AK Party, the Justice and Development Party. They're the ruling party. They've been now running Turkey since 2002. You can see they did extremely well throughout the country. You'll find the Republican People's Party. This is the old party of Mustafa Kemal, and you'll notice they're very strong where. They're very strong, particularly in the west of the country, on the coast. That's not a coincidence. If I were to go back to the earlier maps, you saw the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. These are the descendants of many of the people who came from the Balkans, and these were very much the followers of Mustafa Kemal. And that ideology still remains here, where the idea is we need to be very secular people, Western-looking, as well as nationalists. But what's really striking is when you look in the southeast, and this is where you see the pro-Kurdish party, known as the People's Democracy Party, and right here, where are they winning their votes? They are out in this part of Turkey. So this map right here reflects in the voting, you have a very divided country. And the Kurdish, particularly the Kurdish question, right out here. Now, to complicate this is the fact that Kurds are still compactly settled here, and these areas here are very heavily Kurdish. But the largest city in the world today, in terms largest Kurdish city in terms of population, is not Erbil, which is the capital of Kurdistan in Iraq. It's not Kirkuk in Iraq. It's not Diyarbakir inside of Turkey, which is often kind of seen as a Kurdish capital. It's actually, I say, in an unofficial way, the largest city in Kurdish city in the world in terms of population is Istanbul. It has well over a million Kurds. Over the course, now there have always been Kurds living in this part of Turkey in the Ottoman Empire. There were Kurds there. But over the past several decades, both because of the war that the Turkish state was waging with the PKK, where they drove out a lot of people here, they didn't want to be living in a war zone, so they began moving to the west, but also, more importantly, for economic reasons. The western part of Turkey, particularly Istanbul, Izmir, the coast here, as well as Ankara, that's where the economic growth in Turkey has been. And naturally, it has sucked people out of the southeast of Turkey and the east of Turkey to come to find work. So you have very heavy, large numbers of Kurds are now settled in the western part of Turkey. And this adds a whole other very messy dimension to Turkey's Kurdish problem. So I mentioned that in the summer of 2015, the PKK has resumed its war against the Turkish state. And in a number of Kurdish cities, including Diyarbakir and some others in the southeast, they now have very young Kurds who actually set up all sorts of barricades inside the cities and have declared they're no longer under the rule of the Turkish state. In this case, they're actually well armed. In many cases, just youth, sometimes with just rocks. But this is just to underscore there is a very serious, and effectively, there's a civil war going on in Turkey right now. Now, this makes it extremely difficult for the United States in dealing with Turkey, because as many of you are probably aware, in the struggle against the Islamic State, one of the most and probably the most effective fighting force against the Islamic State has been a group known as the PYD. You don't need to remember these acronyms, because the PYD, they're inside of Syria. They are effectively are not effectively, they are the same group as the PKK. The PKK, so this group that had its emergence in fighting Turkey, was able to establish itself both inside Iraq and inside of Syria. And this happened early in the 1980s because of rivalries between Syria and Turkey. So the Syrian government was very happy to support the PKK and use them against Turkey and let them into the country. So they established themselves there. They also took advantage of the way that Iraq fell apart under Saddam Hussein and have established themselves in Iraq. So their command is based inside of northern Iraq, and they have units inside of Syria and have done a very good job at mobilizing Kurds inside of Syria. So at the same time that these Kurdish units are fighting against the Islamic State, oftentimes now with American support, they are also fighting inside of Turkey against the Turkish government. And this is a total nightmare for the Turks. Now, because the lesson that every Turk is raised with from this experience of Ottoman decline that you saw the maps early on is that the outside world wants to break us up, and they're always looking to find differences in our population to justify, well, this group is different from that group, so therefore we really should split this territory and take this swath of territory from you. And, you know, this is absurd, you know, the Turks would say this to you. Well, the America's real goal in the Middle East is to break up Turkey. In fact, many Turks believed in 2003 when we went into Iraq that the goal was not to go after Saddam Hussein. But really what the United States wanted to do was to go into Iraq in order to start breaking up Turkey, because we already had the northern part of Iraq was Kurdish. Now we're going to go in and finish the job by establishing ourselves in Iraq so we could support the Kurds in Turkey from breaking away. So, and many of you probably have heard this saying before, just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean that they aren't out to get you. So I would tell Turks, you know, this is nuts. Why would, you know, the U.S. looks at the Middle East, you know, I try to explain, can't you see we don't know what we're doing? And the problems we have with Saddam Hussein, and to think that we're going after Saddam Hussein in order really to go after Turkey, you're nuts. Well, you know, I try to tell them things like that, and then things like this happen. This is a map published by some of you may have heard of Ralph Peters. He's a retired Army colonel. This was published, I think it was in 2006, in I think it's Armed Services Journal. So it's not an official statement by the U.S. Army, but it is a journal published by the U.S. Army. And he had an article in there about, well, we're having obviously big problems in the Middle East, and one way to solve this, he suggested, was let's just redesign the borders. And I'm not going to go explain to you every instance of how much ignorance is shown in this map. This map would only create more problems. It wouldn't solve them. But the one thing I do want to draw your attention to is you'll notice here, Ralph Peters says, wouldn't it be a great idea if we established something called, you know, Free Kurdistan? And you look, well, where is that? Where are the new borders? So you see Diyarbakir, which is solidly inside of the Turkish Republic today. Ralph Peters, a U.S. Army officer publishing in the U.S. military journal, is putting a map and suggesting we should establish a Kurdish state that will take a good chunk of Turkey with it, as well as with Iraq and as well as with Iran and Syria. So you try to sell Turks, look, we aren't out to break up your country, that's not what we're trying to do, and then they can show this map in your face. And this map got a lot of attention inside of Turkey. And that's why when the Turks see what we're doing inside of Syria, they're thinking, are they really wanting to get the Islamic State, or are they trying to use this as an excuse to break up our country? Now, so coming to what's going on today in Russia's role in some of this, this is a map that's showing what's going on inside the current state of affairs inside of Syria. So it was in 2011 as part of the Arab Spring, where an uprising began against the leader, Bashar al-Assad, in Syria. Initially, the protests were peaceful. Assad, whether because he knew what was going to happen to the country or whether he wanted simply to suppress any demonstrations, suppressed it very severely, saying these guys are going to be Islamists and they're going to destroy our republic. And that's as a result of those demonstrations, sure enough, there did begin an armed resistance to his government. And without going through all the details, that resistance ended up joining up with the groups that were fighting in Iraq, and they formed what was known as the Islamic State of Iraq in Syria. You know, ISIS is one popular acronym that we use in English for it. And you'll see, I think it's the gray areas show the areas controlled by ISIS. And you'll see here, this is the area, sort of kind of this pinkish area that's controlled by the Syrian state. These are controlled, sort of the yellowish areas are controlled, yellow, greenish kind of area, are those controlled by opponents of the Iraqi state who are Islamists but aren't affiliated with ISIS. And you'll see here, in this purple, are where we have the Kurds, who look very attractive to us because they are effective fighters against ISIS, and the fact that they are fighting not in the name of Islam, but they're fighting in the name of Kurdish nationalism. But again, the key problem from Turkey looks at them and say they are, that's the PKK, they are fighting us inside of Turkey, they are right on our borders here, and they have been trying to link up with this enclave in Syria, so the goal of the PKK is to establish a completely unified area inside of Syria, which Turkey regards as a major, major threat, because once they have that, then the next thing is going to be, well, now we have our eyes on the territory inside of Turkey. Now, complicating all this has been Russia. So what is Russia doing in Syria? And here I'll just speak really very briefly. In 2011, as mentioned, you had this part of this Arab Spring. The Arab Spring very much concerned Moscow for two reasons. One is that it looked like this was something, and to them it looked like this was something engineered by the United States. They were really quite convinced that the United States, the CIA in particular, had been agitating among in Egypt, Tunisia, and in Syria, trying to bring down these governments in the name of democracy. Now, why were they so quick to finger the CIA in this? Because it looked to them that this is very similar to the so-called color revolutions, if you might recall, that took place earlier in the 2000s in Georgia, in Kyrgyzstan, and in Ukraine, where these were pro-the democratic movements that were also happened to be very anti-Russian. And that got a lot of favorable, not simply coverage in the United States in the media, but also some significant support from the U.S. government. So this looked like all parts of the Russians looked like the Americans had a grand strategy of using civil society groups and ostensibly pro-democracy groups in order to bring down existing governments and install American, what they would see as equivalent to American puppet regimes. So their first instinct when they saw this taking place in Syria was, you know, if we don't stop the Americans in Syria, they're going to be on our doorstep again, as they were with Georgia, and as we again now are in Ukraine. So one idea is, you know, we've got to stop the Americans any way we can. The second reason is the Russians, I think now they understand that there is no grand American plan. Because as you know, what happened with the Arab Spring in Syria turned into what? ISIS. We overthrew Gaddafi. You know, Obama, who said he wasn't going to be meddling in the Middle East, decides let's overthrow Gaddafi, whose last words, one of them, among his last words, not his very last ones, but he was warning in the months before he was overthrown, telling in his speech to the Libyan people, saying, you know, with the West, what's going to happen is the West, if they overthrow me, they are going to, Islamists are going to come to power, they're going to try to make you live under Sharia, and then the West is going to bomb them in the name of fighting terrorism, which turned out to be exactly what happened. And so the Russians sort of saw this happen. They thought this was going to happen in 2011. Sure enough, it is what happened, and that is a special concern to Moscow, because it has had its own problems fighting militant Islam, particularly in the Caucasus inside of Chechnya. So that's the area actually that got me interested in, that sent me off to get a PhD. What was the Caucasus and my experiences when I was living in what was then the Soviet Union, and then later working in Moscow for a law firm, was having Chechen friends, etc. So that's been a major problem for Russia. And the Russians have had a long experience of fighting Islamists, and they understand you start toppling these regimes, what comes after them is not nice pro-democracy people, but you get crazy Islamists. And there are, in fact, there are a lot of Russian citizens and citizens from the former Soviet republics who are fighting in Syria. So those are kind of the two reasons why the Putin regime has been wanted to stop the U.S. in this program, stop the U.S. in general, stop the U.S. Program of promoting democracy in revolutionary war and shaking up regimes, and then also to fight the Islamists there rather than at home. So it was earlier this year when Russia had been sympathetic to Assad and been helping, but it was last year when they began deploying forces there and began carrying out airstrikes. And this is Chelyabinsk airstrikes, January 20th to 25th, hitting these opponents of the regime here, and then ISIS as well in these spots. A lot of people in the American community were very angry the Russians were doing this, and then we're predicting things as though Russia's going to have the same experience they had in Afghanistan. They're going to a quagmire. This is very stupid. I think very much a misreading of what the Russians were doing. Americans thinking that, one, remember the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan was 10 years. They committed roughly at the height of something like 100,000 troops to Afghanistan. Think of how long it was the American been in Afghanistan. We went in, what, 2001? We've been there for 15 years, longer than they had, and we're still not out. And we've had more troops inside of Afghanistan, not currently, but we've had more Americans in Afghanistan than the Soviets, and we've gotten about as much out of it. I mean, if we were to pull out Afghanistan today, the Taliban would be in power again. Afghanistan, Soviets didn't do so well there, but we haven't done any better. Number two, the bigger thing, though, the point is the Russians have been dealing with Islam. Well, Islam's been part of the territory that we know as Russia longer than Russia has been in existence. That is, the Russians have been dealing with Muslims for well over a millennium. They have plenty of experience. They know in many ways, and they've been involved in the Middle East, and they've been involved particularly with the Kurds, which I won't say anything about that. That would be a separate lecture. But they know what they're doing, at least as much as we know what we're doing, and I think actually they could deal more. And going in, their goal of going in here, they know it's not a quagmire for the Russians, because their goal is, look, they're not looking to say, we need to unite all Syria before we can leave. They want to go in and make sure Assad is not toppled. They keep this guy in power inside of Damascus. And they know he doesn't need all that much to keep him there, because the people rallying around Assad know that if we lose this war, we're all going to get our heads cut off by ISIS, because a lot of the people around Assad, again, are non-Sunni Muslims. There's some numbers of the Christians there, and that regime, they really have their backs against the wall. So the support behind Assad is pretty solid, but no less important is that the other key player in this region is Iran. And the Iranians know that if they let Assad go, that they're only going to be having the problem fighting, and this gets into a proxy war that Rick mentioned earlier. You have the Saudis involved in this, trying to stop the Iranians. As the Iranians and the Shiites, the Iranians are Shiites, and ISIS is extremely anti-Shiite. Their attitude, too, is it's better to fight these guys inside of Syria rather than on our borders. In Iran, not a small country, very heavily invested in military terms inside of Iraq, inside of Syria. They have advisors. They give prop up the Assad regime with weapons, with a lot of money. They also have Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shiite group that we usually think of the group that was fighting Israel. They're spending all their time fighting ISIS now inside of Syria. So the Russians are, Iran's not going to let this regime fall. So we're just going to help out the Iranians a little more. It's not a huge investment. And the payoff is that they get to keep money, keep Assad in power, and now they are players in the region. Now, my final thing would be just to mention the shooting down of the Russian jet that took place back in November. So this is when the Turks shot down a Russian jet. Extremely provocative move. No one knows exactly what was behind that. I think and to what extent were the Americans, Turkey's a NATO ally, which makes it so dangerous for us that they did this. Now, a lot of people would suggest that there's no way the Turks would have done this on their own. And probably the American says you can go ahead and do it. And I can imagine that, you know, that's quite plausible, in that the Americans and the Turks both might have wanted to down the jet to send a signal to the Russians that don't think you can provoke us without any kind of retaliation. This ties into what's been going to Ukraine, right, where there have been forces fighting inside of Ukraine that ostensibly are Ukrainians, but in fact everybody knows they're really Russians. That they aren't wearing Russian uniforms, but there's no doubt that they're actually Russian servicemen, and they are fighting there sort of unofficially. So it's, you know, one way that Putin has been able to effectively carry out an invasion of Ukraine without admitting it. And it puts NATO and the United States very big. How do we respond to that? Because if you sent Russian tanks across, then you could say, okay, this is clearly an act of war. But when it's people who aren't wearing official Russian uniforms, you can't quite do that, and you have to think, is it worth going to war with Russia over this? At the same time, Russia's been very provocative in the way they've been violating with their submarines, poking around in Sweden, and other places in the Baltic, Russian jets in NATO around the, and again in the Baltics, even Britain, sometimes even with the U.S., you know, violating airspace, etc. So they've been very deliberately provocative in that way. I think that's when Putin's trying to send something to the Americans. You guys are mucking around in Ukraine. This is right next to us. It's been part of our history. In fact, before Russia came into existence, you know, it was in Kiev, where Russian culture and civilization come from. But again, very close to Russia. And the Russians are thinking, why in the world are the Americans mucking around here? Well, we better send a signal to them. So each side, I think, has been trying to be provocative towards the other. I think the downing of the jet is a lot safer to do this in Syria, in the Middle East, where everyone knows things are messy, rather than, let's say, doing it over the skies of Estonia. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is the Turks may have done it on their own, because if you look where the Russians have been bombing, and in particular in the days leading up to the downing of the jet, they've been bombing some groups that are very heavily supported by Turkey. For reasons I didn't get into, Turkey very much wants to see Assad overthrown. And so they've been active in backing groups inside of Syria. And I think they might have seen the Russian attacks on that group, you know, right across its border as just being unbearable. It's all kind of humiliation of Turkey that the groups, some of them ethnic Turks inside of Syria, are being whacked by the Russians, and there's been no response. The Turks can't accept that, and lifts down one of their jets. two final points. Putin was furious about this. I think he was genuinely surprised. I don't think he expected this would happen. And he thought that there was this alliance between Turkey, the U.S., other powers, the Great Britain, etc., to fight ISIS. That they were all in it together, and so for them, for the Turks now, he saw it as a stab in the back. Now this may have been play acting by Putin, but I think he really was surprised and did feel a sense of betrayal. Now, why is it, and this would be one of the final point, and coming back to why is this also important to the, so difficult for the U.S., they might have been emphasizing Turkey's role in this. You have this group, the Islamic State, who are as radical Islamists as you can get. The current government in Turkey is one that is not as emphatically secularist as previous governments in Turkey have been, but they are not at all like the Islamic State. And in fact, the Islamic State, I'm sure if they had Erdogan, the first thing they would do, they would love to cut off his head. They do not regard him as a proper Muslim. Erdogan does see himself as very much as a pious Muslim, but these guys don't. So the question is, why is Turkey dealing with these guys? And it's not because they're saying, oh, we're both really having this Islamic affinity. It's because the way Turkey sees it, these guys are the one actor, the one they're fighting against Assad, the Turks want to see overthrown, and against the Kurds. So for Turkey, so the Turks see ISIS as an enemy, but on their priorities, it's the Kurds who are far and away the biggest one. Because this is the real existential threat. As bad as ISIS, they can go into Turkey, they can set off bombs, which they have, they can kill people, they can create some havoc, but they aren't going to break up the country the way the Kurds might. And that's why it's been so difficult for the U.S. to coordinate its policies with Turkey, because as far as we can see, you know, we don't like Assad, we want to see him overthrown, but we really don't like the Islamic State. So our number one goal in Syria is let's take care of the Islamic State, and you know, we're willing to not put a lot of pressure on Assad right now. But the Kurds, you know, what's there not to like? These guys are only fighting for in the name of Kurdish nationalism. Now, they aren't Islamists, and they don't present any immediate threat to the United States or any sort of existential threat in any sense to the United States. That they look like, again, they're very natural allies. But to Turkey, you couldn't think of a worse enemy. And this is not a product of the last 5 years or 10 years, but it goes back to the very beginnings of the Turkish Republic. And it is hardwired in Turkish institutions. By that I mean in Turkish schools, you're taught the indivisibility about your borders and how important it is to maintain that, to maintain the unity of the country. And then that only gets reinforced when you're in the Turkish army, you're in Turkish intelligence, you're in Turkish police forces, et cetera, et cetera. This is it's very difficult to, I guess maybe the idea of Turkey collaborating, I guess Turkey collaborating with the Kurds inside of Syria is the same idea how difficult as it is for us, although it's even more difficult for them, but as difficult as it would be for us to say we're going to ally with Al-Qaeda against the Islamic State. That if you had a president saying, okay, imagine Osama bin Laden was still around, and we said, okay, we're going to cut a deal and supply Osama bin Laden with arms, and we're going to coordinate actions with him to go after the Islamic State. You know, Americans would be furious about that. And that's, it's multiplied. We lost, what, around slightly over 3,000 people in the 9/11 attacks. There have been 30,000 to 40,000 people have died in the war against the PKK since the 1980s. So it's extremely difficult for the Turks to deal with. I've gone on for quite some time, so why don't I stop here and allow you finally to ask some questions. Yes?
Regarding the Kurdish-Turkey dispute, how should it be resolved? How will it be resolved? And secondly, how about Turkey and the EU should it be?
So how should the Kurdish, Turkish... that resolution is not, I mean, there was a chance, at least the closest thing there was to a chance several years ago, when the, you have this new party, the AKP, this is the party of Erdogan, came into power in 2002. They were a very different party in Turkey. Most of the attention was focused on the fact that they were more pro-Islam. Many of them are very strongly, in fact, most of them, almost the party leadership, very strongly believers, pious believers. They have been members of political parties that had been shut down repeatedly because the Turkish ruling authorities, following the ideology of Mustafa Kemal, which was very strongly secularist, and forbade any formal mixing of religion and politics, constantly shut these guys, their parties down. So they established this thing called the Justice and Development Party. And you know, that has kind of an anodyne name, Justice and Development, right? What is that? You know, who's against justice, who's against development? Their party symbol is a light bulb, so absolutely nothing to do with Islam. And they said, we're a new party, we're really not about Islam, we're about democracy, and we just, at most, we simply want to keep the state out of religion. I should mention, you might say, you know, Turkish secularism is very different from American. The American is the idea that the wall between church and state, that neither should meddle in the other's affairs. And the Turkish secularism, it's not that the state shouldn't meddle in religion, it's that religion should be subjected to the state. That should be controlled by the state. So all mosques in Turkey are run by the state. Religious education is controlled by the state. If you want to be a preacher, you can only do it if you're licensed by the state. You have to be educated. You know, and they control everything with formal religion. The AKP wanted to say, hey, look, it's okay if someone wants to wear a headscarf, for example. They should be able to do that and go to a university. So they were sort of saying, we just want to lighten things up. And they have not, in spite of all the rhetoric about Erdogan being Muslim, I mean, there's something to that. Things have changed some in Turkey, but they've not changed the fundamental secular basis of Turkish state. state or society. In fact, because they themselves have not been living by anything like Islamic law for generations. So they themselves don't really know what is Islamic law and how would you live by it. But coming on to come to the Kurdish part, what was significant here was that this was the first time you had a party, first time you had a party that could be so open about the fact that, look, we don't regard Mustafa Kemal as a deity, which had been, everybody had this kind of said Mustafa Kemal is like a demigod, and he's infallible, and you couldn't criticize him. They were like, look, the guy lived in this historical era, what he said back then may not apply today, we should be open to that, we can use our own minds to think. Number two, they were able to think, we were law-abiding peoples, and yet we were thrown into jail because we were accused of being terrorists, or we were accused of wanting to serve the government simply because we wanted to practice Islam. And they looked at the Kurds initially, saying, you guys too have been mistreated by this Turkish nationalism. A lot of the Muslims were uncomfortable with Turkish nationalism because Islam teaches that nations and people shouldn't be divided by nationalism, religion's more important than your ethnic identity. And so they looked at the Kurds as, hey, they're a group like us that was kicked around and beaten by the Turkish state unfairly. They just wanted to be Kurds, and they were put in jail. They were tortured sometimes for that. And they were also seen as, hey, these guys are fellow Muslims. And we can get along with them on the fact that we share something in common, which is Islam. And so this was the initial, the program of this AKP was essentially, let's work on depoliticizing ethnic identities. Because they realized if we keep pushing this Turkish nationalism, one they thought is wrong, both ethically, morally it's wrong because it contradicts Islam. But they also saw politically this is an impossibility of keeping the Kurds in our state, just to come back to, these people, if you keep insisting you're not going to assimilate these Kurds here, that we keep trying to tell them they're Turks, it ain't going to work because it hasn't worked for several decades. And so let's admit the fact that they're Kurds and depoliticize ethnic identity so that somebody, and this is why Turkey began opening up to its neighbors, the Arab countries, etc., and instituting visa-free travel. And the idea was, let's not talk about Turkish nationalism. Someone like saying, sitting Jarrah here, who's Kurdish, can say, I can go into Aleppo, into Syria, for business or for pleasure. I can go into Iraq, into the Kurdish parts of Iraq, and I can go to Istanbul and travel here, and if I can stay at home and say, hey, I'm a Kurd, dressed in the Kurdish fashion with everyone that is Kurd, well, do I really need a Kurdish state? And so rather than putting it in their face, Kurds every day, you have to pretend you're a Turk, that they would solve this problem. I could go into the details, but the big problem, and one of the big problems is that Erdogan, so initially they were pushing that, they have now dropped that idea and said, we have to crush the PKK. And so a lot of people here blame what's going on in Turkey for the worst, they blame it on Erdogan. They are giving, which I think is a huge mistake, they're giving the PKK a free ride here. PKK is a group you probably picked up, again, established in the 1980s, they're still around. Not only do they have units inside of Turkey, not only are they behind the war inside of Turkey, but they actually are the ones who control the Kurdish parts of Syria and their northern Iraq. My point is this. They are very effective. They are very disciplined. And they're fanatical in their own way. And for these guys, the worst possible thing for the leadership of this organization would be if Kurds in Turkey would say, okay, if they're going to let us speak our language and let us say we're Kurds, and leave us be, well then we'll stay part of the government. What do we need the PKK for? So if you are running the PKK, you have an incentive to not come to a democratic solution, but instead to restart the war, which is exactly what the PKK has done. There is this group, this is the one that got the votes, the People's Democratic Party, they got the votes out here, and they had a very sort of liberal, they have pushing Kurdish rights and the rights of others inside of Turkey, and they were able to get even non-Kurds to vote for them, which was a very positive development. But they're very much controlled by the PKK, and one way by starting up the war is polarizing people in Turkey, and is also undercutting the HDP. That is, the HDP was beginning to emerge as rivals of the Kurdish PKK. It's controlled by them, but they, the militant wing, because they were, they might have come to a democratic solution. So I guess I want to say that it's both the current government in Turkey deserves some blame for it, but so do the PKK. That is, they want to keep it polarized. As the PKK sees right now, particularly what's been going on in Syria, this is the first time ever that U.S. officially regards the PKK as a terrorist organization, because they carried out terrorism throughout the 1980s and 90s. I remember even when I was doing my dissertation work in research in Turkey, they were counting suicide bombings, and they would send young girls, like 16-year-old girls, 17-year-old girls, to blow themselves up. Not in the name of Islam, but in the name of Kurdish nationalism, because they really know how to brainwash people. So it's a nasty organization, and it's one that does not want to see peaceful resolution, and they say to themselves, now we actually have the sympathy of America and the Western government. So rather than saying, so in other words, now's the time to really push our advantage here, and we can grab something inside of Syria, and we're eventually be able to force the Turks to give up part of Turkey. I mean, that's how it looks to me.
Is that the state?
And get a separate state, right. They there's this rhetoric that comes out of the PKK, we don't want a separate state, we want a self-rule. I'm not buying it, though. I think they really do want a separate state. The reason for that is one of those things, a lot of the people, I saw this a lot among Chechens, too. A lot of people, for ethnic reasons, have a certain ethnic identity and think if they don't have their own state, that somehow they're lesser because of it. And things, once they go on, when you get a state, your life doesn't get any better, and now you're suddenly accused by others of oppressing. It becomes an albatross of anything around your neck. The one other thing I should mention in Turkey is that a lot of people presenting the place of Kurds inside of Turkey vastly exaggerated, and some might have taken this misinterpreted some of my comments to imply that if you're Kurdish, you get beat up by the Turks. If you're Kurdish, if you're willing to go along and say I'm a Turk, you can do anything you want. There have been prime ministers in Turkey who have Kurdish background, and there's no problem whatsoever of passing as a Turk if you're a Muslim. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do, and no one really looks into that.
I think we should thank our speaker.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.